I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. If you're a musician looking to produce a new record or a director who needs funding for a documentary film idea, you can now pitch your project to strangers online. Kickstarter is a leading crowdsourcing website that connects artists and innovators with potential funders. My guest is Yancey Strickler, the co-founder of Kickstarter.
When we launched, it was just us. We were a team of five. We had no one of any weight behind us. We had no big investment. And when we go around to venture capital firms and talk to people about our idea, people did not like it. People did not respond to it. We had that four-year gap where the site couldn't launch. It was not a happy period. You wake up and you think, is today the day that the three people in Palo Alto with this exact same idea, they launched theirs because they worked a little bit harder.
Coming up, we'll learn how Yancey Strickler and his partners launched Kickstarter from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you were growing up, did you have a sense that you would be an entrepreneur?
Never. My entire goal growing up was to be a writer. I loved to read. I was always good at school, you know, but my dream was to be a writer. And, you know, there were various books that made me want to do that. All the President's Men was a book I reread all the time, and I very desperately wanted that kind of experience. And that's what I pursued through college. And, you know, I took it very seriously, and I got my first freelance writing jobs during college. And after school, I became a writer full time. And that was sort of living the dream, moving here to New York and doing that. And then I think there was a certain point where I realized that that world is a little small for me, that maybe I was better at more things beyond just writing and thinking about language and how to write about music or whatever the topic was. And so I sort of realized I started working in companies and organizations that I thrived in those situations, that I could be decisive. I knew how to do various things. But, you know, this whole thing with Kickstarter just sort of fell into it.
What do your parents do? Are they in the literary field?
Not at all. I mean, my father's sells furniture. My mother was a secretary. She recently went back to school and now is an accountant. My stepfather's a auto mechanic, and my stepmother sells real estate. So it's a working class family. I grew up certainly not having money in a very rural area in Southwest Virginia outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, where Virginia Tech is. And it's a great place to grow up. But nothing about it would lead me to where I've gotten to be now. I think that, you know, growing up in a small town like that, you're unaware of how big the rest of the world is. And, you know, fortunately through books and all these other ways, I got this greater sense of what possibility there was.
You grew up on a farm. Who was the farmer?
Well, we rented a house. There's this old house built in 1863, I think it was. It's a white house with a red tin roof, and you could see the house from about 5 miles away because the roof would just pop out of the trees. It was kind of nice. But it's this falling down house, and we just rented it. Our family did for $100 a month, and farmers worked the land. So I would work for them during the summers, but they would raise cattle there, and they're, you know, cattle for beef, so they would take them away, and you'd hear the rest of the cows cry, you know, that mm-hmm. night. And there was, you know, there was sort of a rhythm to it. It's a nice thing to talk about now, being in New York, because it makes me exotic, but I hated it at the time. I mean, I just wanted to read books and, you know, think about things like that. I did not thrive on country living. But I look back at it now with some level of fondness.
So the farming life wasn't for you, and you wanted to be a writer. Did your parents ever push back on that?
Not at all. I was never pressure whatsoever. I think if any, my father wanted me to be a rock star, so it might have been the opposite direction. But.
Speaking of rock star, you have an interest in music. You were a music journalist or a music critic prior to starting Kickstarter. What role did music play in your life?
It was huge. I mean, my My father wanted to be a musician his entire life. He was a folk artist, and he had bands. I played very briefly in a band with him when I was in high school, a band called Rock Bottom, which is kind of appropriately named. And but music was always, you know, was my identity, you know. And I was a weird kid in high school, and, you know, I was one of those kids. But music is where I saw this other world that I could possibly be a part of. And as someone who is, you know, intelligent and is curious, you know, that quest for learning more about music is a very exciting thing, especially pre-internet. Mm-hmm. You know, I would buy magazines just to look for names of bands I'd never heard of before so I could try to find out what they sounded like. So that that level of discovery was a huge part of how I grew as a person. And I played music myself, not very well, and eventually realized I couldn't make music that I myself liked, and that was a hard thing to recognize. And so then I began, you know, to write and, you know, use my ability to be pretty strong with words and to talk about records that I liked. But at a certain point, that sort of gets to be not enough. It's not, you know, emotionally fulfilling.
Since there was some type of frustration with your career prior mm-hmm. to starting Kickstarter, to what extent did you start the company because of that, you know, you're having itchy feet to do something else versus really having a visceral interest, a holistic interest in the company?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely wholly a strong, genuine interest in what we do. I mean, it really is it. But, you know, it's not hard to look at the music industry and think this is not going to be here for very long. And, you know, I look at my very good friends who are still in that world, and not many of them are employed anymore. And so, you know, you're watching the sand leave the hourglass, and, you know, you're starting to think, I need to get out of here. So certainly that was in the air. But, you know, the Kickstarter is without question the greatest thing I've ever had the privilege to do with my life. And I don't know if I'll ever have the opportunity to do something so good again.
Your co-founder, Perry Chen, had the original idea for Kickstarter. You met him randomly at a restaurant in Brooklyn. What was that first encounter like?
Perry first had the idea in 2002. He's from New York originally, and he moved back to New Orleans, where he also went to college. And he went there, and he was trying to put on a concert. And he didn't have the money to do it. It was going to cost, you know, a lot of money up front to make it happen. And out of that, you know, he wished that there was some way he could know beforehand how many people were interested. If a certain number were interested, the show could happen because there were enough people. If there weren't, then the show wouldn't happen. And just this very simple trigger. Mm. And that was really the origin of Kickstarter right there. And so then in 2005, fall of 2005, there's a restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn called Diner, and it's a nice restaurant. And I used to go there a lot, and Perry was a waiter there. And we got to be friends, and, you know, eventually one day he mentioned this idea he had. And, you know, he mentioned it to me because at the time my day job was working on the web in an editorial way, but I worked on the internet. And so that, you know, that meant I knew more about the web than he did, and so I could help him with this idea. So he shared this concept to me of this trigger that people decide for themselves what gets funded and what happens. And so, you know, I could see the merit of it, although I was a little nervous about it at first too, because I thought, well, this is American Idol. This isn't how you create great art. But as we talked it through more, just thinking of all those niches and enclaves in the world that just get ignored, but there is a support system there and a fan base there and all that who could decide for themselves. And then about a year later, we met Charles, who I mentioned before, our third founder. And Charles was more technical than either of us. He was a designer, but we still didn't have that core tech team. And that took a while to put together. So from the moment of really working on this in a very concentrated way to the site's launch, there's 4 years in between there.
What did you do to support yourself in those 4 years?
Well, I still had my day job. I was working at a music service called eMusic at the time. So I was doing that during the day, and at night I was working on this. Perry quit waiting. I mean, he was full-time trying to make Kickstarter happen. And he had some savings, and he lives light anyway. And same with Charles. You know, there's no way this doesn't happen if the two of them aren't working at this full-time and refusing to let this fail. I mean, there were numerous opportunities for us to quit. And there are times where, you know, empirically maybe we should have, but there was a persistence and a stubbornness that saw it through.
What were some turning points in those early days before the site launched that you thought, you know what, actually we're going to stick with this? And by the way, it was inexpensive for you because you were doing your other job anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I had more of a safety net, and I was I mean, that was a source of conflict for sure. You know, mm-hmm. the one guy who doesn't quit his job. But I just, you know, I had no money and no way to hack it. And, I just wasn't ready for that jump. And so there are a number of milestones, good and bad. I mean, the biggest mistake that we made and a mistake that I think a lot of people probably now are making is that we tried to outsource the development of the site. So we ourselves did not know how to code. So we went to outside firms and hired them to code the site. And, you know, we were repeatedly told by the few people we met in the tech world that this is a terrible idea. This never works. Like, this never works out. And our reaction to that was, whatever, old man. You know, what do you know? It's different for us. You don't know how it is these days. And we really believed that. And then we realized after going down that path two or three different times and it not working out in really significant ways that we realized that this was true. So a big turning point there was we met a woman named Sunny Bates. And Sunny is a Uber connector. She's the fastest talker you will ever meet. She lives here in the city. And she's just a lovely woman. Sunny shares a dog walker with a friend of Perry's from college, and so we met Sunny through that, and we became just the two downtown boys that she got to help out, and she really liked us immediately, and we just were blown away by her, and she's just a force. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know anybody, and so we told her our idea, and we were these, you know, two earnest guys with a piece of paper, and she was like, I'll take you around. I'll introduce you. So we're able to talk to people that we definitely would not have otherwise.
Who are some of the people whom you got to talk to and whom you engaged as a result of your connection with Sunny?
Yeah, like a really important one would be Katarina Fake, who is the founder of Flickr and founder of Hunch. Through Katarina, we were introduced to Andy Bayo, and Andy was an early advisor of ours and our CTO for a little while. Andy founded a site called upcoming.org in the early 2000s that was sold to Yahoo. He runs a blog called waxy.org, which is one of the best blogs on the web. He's basically the internet's resident nice guy. And so Andy brought us a lot of credibility. When we launched and when people first covered us, I think TechCrunch wrote about us the day we launched. I think they said Andy Bayo's new startup. You know, he wasn't a founder. He was involved. But, you know, we would take it. You know, it's great to be associated with him. Mm-hmm. And he also helped us find technical talent. So, mm-hmm. you know, a hard task when you're not technical yourself is you meet someone and you have no idea of how to tell how good they are. So that was a big help. And basically just from the moment we met Sunny, there was momentum.
Right. And you also have gotten support from people like Jack Dorsey, one of the Twitter founders. Is it financial support, among other things?
Yeah. He's an angel investor. We have a few really interesting angel investors, him, Joshua Schechter, who founded Delicious, and Katarina, who I mentioned, and Fred Wilson and Union Square Ventures are our primary backers.
We talk about, you know, crowdsourcing. Did you in any way feel like, oh, as I'm starting a company related to crowdsourcing, that's what I'm doing myself, is getting a crowd of people kind of funding my business?
Well, it's funny. When we would go around with the idea and we were just, you know, a couple people with a piece of paper, people inevitably would suggest, why don't you kickstart Kickstarter, you know, get people to put the money in and create the company that way. And SEC regulations prevent any exchange of equity on a case like that. But we did take that tact in the sense that we thought, let's get as many people as possible who we think will believe in the idea, who can be advocates for us, and let's get them to put in, you know, just a small amount of money. So that's definitely been a conscious approach that we've taken because, you know, one of the big ideas of Kickstarter is that a community could be a great sense of support and encouragement, and they can spread your word far, you know, spread word about your project far and wide, and we definitely thought very hard about that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. We'll hear more from Yancey coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. There's a book by James Surowiecki called The Wisdom of Crowds, where the more independent people you have in a population, the more accurate an answer or an outcome will be. To what extent was that kind of ringing in your ear when you were getting this off the ground, if at all?
We read it. I mean, that came out at the time that we were working on this, and it was certainly intriguing. And, you know, it's nice to get that pop psychology reinforcement for what it is you're thinking about.
But that's all that it was?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were driven by a few different things. I mean, a core motivation was this acknowledgement of the fact that for an idea to have any value in culture, it had to generate money. That ideas that did not, in the end, generate revenue for someone else were considered valueless. You could not get a loan for those ideas. You could not get a venture capitalist to invest. You could not get a film studio to finance that. A record label would be scared of it. Everyone's just looking for a return on investment because they're businesses. But yet, 99% of ideas are just ideas. It's a thing in your head that you want to have exist in the real world. If it makes you money, great. No one's going to, cry about that. But in the end, you just want the thing to happen. You want that personal satisfaction. So we thought, we could construct a place that functions differently, where ideas are judged based on the passion of the person behind it, the quality of their craft, the connection with their audience, and what the audience itself thinks. The means of doing that was almost secondary to that idea. So, we get called a crowdfunding site accurately. That's sort of the term the web has come up with to describe these kinds of things. But that's not a word that's anywhere on our website. It's not a word that's ever spoken about in our office. It's not a word that we ever talked about leading up to this. I mean, I could care less about crowdfunding. It's a mechanism. Really, it's this bigger idea that matters. This crowdfunding thing is just a means to get there.
Right. You are enabling creators to create regardless of what a market might say.
Absolutely.
How does Kickstarter work?
So Kickstarter funding is all or nothing. So I create a project. I say how much money I need to complete it, and I give myself an amount of time to reach it. We suggest 30 days. That's the typical thing that people do. So we need $5,000 in 30 days. Now, if that person is able to raise that $5,000 or more by the time of that deadline, at that point, everyone is charged, and that person gets their money, and they go and they do their thing. If they come up short of their goal, then no one is charged at all, and everyone just walks away like nothing happened. Now, people choose to back projects because they get something in exchange. So it's not a tip jar. It's not a donation platform. So if I give you $10, I get $10 of something back, a copy of the CD, a copy of the book. For higher amounts, you offer, more experimental things or experiential things. So I'll name a character after you, or I'll come do a reading at your house, or we'll play a private show, or you get a walk-on role in the film. People are able to offer whatever it is that they want to do. And so 44% of projects thus far have reached their goal successfully.
Can you talk to me about some of those people who have pitched their project online? What are some of your favorite ones?
There's a project that we had early on by a woman named Emily Richmond, and she's an artist from L.A., and as part of this project, she is sailing around the world alone. It will take her 2 years to circumnavigate the globe alone, which is a crazy thing to do. And so one of her rewards, the things that she offered, was for $15, at some point on her trip, she would take a Polaroid picture. And next time she got into port, she would mail it to you from wherever she was. And about 4 months ago, 3 months ago, I got an envelope in the mail with strange stamps on it. And I opened it up, and there was a map. And written on one side of the map was my name. And I unfolded it, and tucked inside was a Polaroid picture. And the background was the ocean, faded Polaroid. And the foreground, a jungle and a beach. And on the map, she had circled the island where she was sitting in the South Pacific. And on the other side, she'd written a letter describing what she saw as she took the photo. Mm-hmm. And I got this for $15. And this is something that is romantic and that has enormous, emotional meaning to me. And I'm just a stranger on the internet, And so that sort of thing can happen.
You contributed $15. How much was she looking to raise altogether?
She's trying to raise $7,000, and she raised about $7,500, something like that. Another one I really like, I like these sort of quixotic projects. They're where my heart kind of lies. There's another one called The Mysterious Letters, and it's by a guy and a girl who are both British. The name's Michael Linka, and they had the very simple idea that they wanted to write everyone in the world a handwritten letter. and they were going to start with some small specific towns. Mm. So they did a project on Kickstarter to do one in a neighborhood of Pittsburgh called Polish Hill. And so on one day, 623 residents of Polish Hill received letters from Michael and Lenka, again, all, you know, very idiosyncratic. And predictably, people freaked out and got very scared, and it got reported to the FBI and became a big story there. Mm-hmm. And people started hanging up signs around Polish Hill that said, "Don't worry, it was an art project." There was an amazing story in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette of the reporter interviewing the shop owner, this older woman, and she was said that she thought it was a nuisance that this letter got, and that she thought it was scary and it could be terrorism and these whole ideas. And in the story it said, after the reporter writing, "After I explained to her that it was an art project, the woman removed the letter from the wastebasket and carefully smoothed it out." And I just thought that was wonderful.
When the public contributes money to support a project, it's not investing. And that's because it's illegal in the United States, although internationally regulation is different. Was that a roadblock initially, or was it your intent initially just to have people contribute?
The intent from the beginning was to not have any equity or any points or anything change hands. And that was the intent even before we knew it would be against the law, even if we thought the other way. I mean, the thinking there was that if we're asking people to look at these things and try to guess whether or not it will be a hit, you're just recreating the same mouse cage that we already have, where people are just trying to get, you know, looking to make a buck off of something. And if someone's being motivated by royalty check in 3 years for $13, what is that? Is that a better world? And so we always like this idea of it being about experiences and products that you get in exchange. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's never any sort of equity or you know, financial return that swaps hands on Kickstarter. It's strictly forbidden.
What other forms of crowd support has there been in history? Is there a precedent for this?
There is. I mean, what's funny is that this is not novel at all, in a way. You know, the original forms that art was primarily produced was through patronage, and it was patronage by the church, by royalty, by the Medici, by rich people, basically, in general. And Beethoven would perform a lot of his symphonies this way, where he would say, "I will only perform this when the hall has sold out, and that's the only way this work will be debuted." You get your name in the program. I mean, it's the exact same thing as now. Whitman used to publish some of his books in that same way. You'd, in the front of the books, he'd list all the people who helped pay for this first run of printing. And so there are hundreds of examples of art being made in this way. And then right around the middle of the 20th century, we started to switch this idea of corporations subsidizing, commoditizing art, and that being the primary way that art was funded.
While this crowd support has been in existence for centuries, to what extent do you think the appetite is ripe for it now? I mean, you've been enabled by Twitter and Facebook existing, but how much have they facilitated what you're trying to do?
The lifeblood of our site is social media. At this point, Kickstarter is mentioned on Twitter about every 8 seconds, I believe it is. So people are just talking about it all the time, talking about their projects, and it's how things are getting discovered. When we were working on this in 2005, there wasn't a Twitter. I guess Facebook probably existed, but I'm not a Harvard grad, so I was not allowed to be a part of it. I mean, it was a MySpace world at that point, and you know, I'm not really sure. I think we had a MySpace widget idea for how people would spread the word, but it was unclear. And so this whole world has grown around this that's allowed this to exist in a much easier way.
Accidentally.
Yeah, accidentally.
What do you think the appetite is for something like this in other countries?
We have no way of knowing. I think that until you see it and interact with it, a lot of what we do sounds very utopian and maybe a little naive. And I think we are a little naive, but we're all right with that. And, you know, we think about this the way that Twitter or Facebook have grown, where, you know, when your first friend started a Twitter account, you probably made fun of them. You know, you thought that's ridiculous. Like, why would you ever do such a thing? And then over time, you realize the purpose that it serves, and it becomes a part of your life as well. And this is this gradual socialization of these new kinds of services, these new means of expression. And we're on that same kind of timeline, and we have that same level of patience for this. I feel sure that with time that this can be a thing that everyone will feel comfortable with.
So artists have this reputation of feeling uncomfortable talking about the business side of their work, yet your site is all about artists connecting with potential supporters or sources of money. Can you talk to me a little bit about that dichotomy?
I mean, you're saying out loud how much money you need to do something. And the way the site is structured, it's not just about money. It's more about the thing that you're doing. But yet, we're all very uncomfortable talking about money in public. We'd rather talk about anything else than money. And for artists in particular, you know, you're just running from money. You don't want to think about it. That's part of the point. And so there is that level of discomfort, and there's that hurdle that we have to get over. And I'm incredibly sympathetic to it. I mean, I feel very similarly. And I also think that people aren't sure about putting themselves out there in the world. You know, J.D. Salinger would be a terrible Kickstarter creator. You know, it's not for everybody. But I think that with time, people can see that this is about more than just the cash. It's about opportunity. It's about building an audience, all those other things.
Along those lines, you know, I asked you prior to the interview, well, how much money have you raised? And you don't want people to know that, which is compatible with this whole artist mentality of wanting to keep that separate. But that doesn't necessarily work anymore. I mean, you see artists, they have to be great marketers, and it's in their best interest.
It's true. You know, for us, in talking about our own financial backing and our own, you know, things like that, we don't view it as being terrifically interesting. So we just didn't feel like that added anything to our story, that it didn't feel like us. It was someone else's story of us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a company that enables the public to fund creative projects. Do you know anybody else with the name Yancey, incidentally?
I've heard tell. There was an NFL player named Yancey. There's an actress named Yancey. But I've never met anyone face-to-face. It's a Southern last name, traditionally. I was named after a family friend. I hated my name for a lot of my life. And only when, I guess it was in high school, I decided to embrace it. But yeah, it's an unusual one.
So going back to the early days of the company, what was more challenging for you than you thought? I mean, you've had kind of a charmed existence, having the support of the media and this strong network of people helping you out.
Well, those people were not there always. You know, when we launched, it was just us. We were a team of five. We had no one of any weight behind us. We had no big investment, and when we would go around to venture capital firms and talk to people about our idea, people did not like it. People did not respond to it. I think that we had that four-year gap where the site couldn't launch, and that was not a happy period. And we would have launched that site in 2006 if we could have, but we couldn't. And you know, you wake up in the morning and you think, is today the day that the three people in Palo Alto with this exact same idea, they launched theirs because they worked a little bit harder, you know, and you have these kinds of anxieties, and no one was getting paid, and it was, you know, it was bootstrapping all the way. You know, I think that there was a lot of emotional toll of especially me having a full-time job and my partners being both fully committed. That caused a lot of stress and a lot of tension, as you can probably understand. Now the problems are interesting. Now the problems are growth.
You founded the company with Perry Chen and Charles Adler, and they were working on the company full-time, and you weren't. So why did they keep you on board as a co-founder if you weren't carrying your weight?
That's a good question. I don't know. We're friends, so that helps. It was not a great period. I don't know the answer to that.
You have a part of your site devoted to product design, and that has been somewhat controversial. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So we started Kickstarter as a platform for creative projects. We meant that pretty broadly. So that's film, music, tech, comics, you know, dance, all kinds of things like that. And then in September 2010, we had a project from two guys in New York named Dan and Tom, and it was a project called The Glyph. And it's a tripod mount for an iPhone 4, and it's a little simple piece of rubber. And they put together a video where they explained how they designed this thing, and they had a very clever sort of commercial for it. And it was a very, very well-done project. And they put it in the design category, and it was a design project, and they were trying to raise $10,000, and they raised about $140,000 very quickly. And the project is basically functioning as a pre-order mechanism. People were buying the glyph from them. And that was the first time we'd had a project like that. And it opened the floodgates to a lot of product design kind of things. And quite a few of those were terrible, and we turned most of those down. But at one point, we had another big one come through by a man named Scott Wilson, who's a designer who lives in Chicago, who designed the Xbox Kinect, among a lot of other big things. And he had a project called the TikTok. And what he did is he designed a watch band that would turn an iPod Nano into a wristwatch. And he was looking to raise $15,000 to do it. And after a month, the project ended with him raising $945,000. And so for his project, that was functioning as, again, as a pre-order mechanism, and some 14,000 people bought this thing. But more than that, they also got a story that they were part of. They were part of the creation of this phenomenon. I mean, it was international news, this project. And all those people got bragging rights and got to be a part of it. But it's also more commercial than the kinds of things that we have traditionally supported on Kickstarter. I mean, our biggest category is documentary film. Documentaries have raised, you know, $15 million on Kickstarter. And something like this, you know, the creation of like a gadget seems a little bit divorced from that. You know, because of the success of the TikTok and other projects like it, we've had a real influx of proposals of people looking to do these kinds of things. And we lit in almost everything at this point after a lot of internal debate. We sort of opened wider to this, but we're still not entirely sure how we feel about it. You know, we like this idea of Kickstarter being a place where you put an idea into the world and the crowd decides, right, whether or not it should happen or it shouldn't. But yet we're not a fully open platform. We don't allow everything. So this has really pushed some of our philosophy a little bit. And to be honest, we're not entirely sure where we stand.
To some extent, these people, even if they have the commercial incentive, are still creators and they're still being creative. So
yeah, just because they happen to work in a different medium than one I feel more comfortable in, you know, that's just as much about my bias as it is anything. And we're very aware of that. Mm-hmm. And we're also aware that, you know, when we started Kickstarter, it was ours. It was this idea we had to protect. But with each day, it's a little bit less ours, and it's more just a thing that exists on its own in the world that a lot of people contribute to. So, you know, you even have to question how much a voice do we have the right to have about mm-hmm. this thing.
What do you do outside of work that gives you pleasure right now?
Right now it's primarily riding my bike. But, you know, outside of that, I read. I read, you know, 3 or 4 books a week probably.
What 2 books have you read this week?
Well, let's see. Right now I'm reading the Tom Shales Oral History of ESPN, which I find fascinating and I actually find to be a really good startup book because it's about the origins of this, what is now a huge, huge company just based on being founded by two men and basically how they lost control of the company and how it's become this other big thing. And then I'm reading The Bridge, the David Remnick biography of Obama. I recently read The Medium is the Massage by Malcolm McLaren, which is a classic 60s sort of post-Marxist theory book about sort of the philosophy of media. That's amazing. I read that 3 times in a day. It's a little 100-page book. And another one that was I really love that I've read multiple times is You Are Not a Gadget by Jerome Lanier, which is a really good book about sort of some philosophies of technology. And he takes a very sort of pessimistic view in a lot of ways about, you know, what technology has done for us. And I enjoy reading those kinds of opinions.
He advises Microsoft.
I believe he does. He also invented virtual reality, and he does. He's a very smart man with some crazy ideas.
Yes, and he has great dreadlocks.
He does.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over 4 countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I'd seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now, rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there were something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had four university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had four university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher, and so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension, basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after four kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents, and in the afternoons I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today that school is one of the top performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly, and it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom, and then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily. I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch. So I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. One was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school. And then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million. And the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus, and we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner? And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, she likes, I mean, just from a paragraph, she
she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, can, you know, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in a first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her. And then at the end, she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she, you know, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money, and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college,
that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for the last for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.